this year? Okay. People who bring Bikurim, and in Mirtzah Hashem, in less than a week, you and I are going to be able to bring Bikurim. And people who bring Bikurim don't just come to the Mikdash with their Shivat Aminim, their figs and their pomegranates or their wheat, and they don't just say, here it is. They say, Arami, Oved Avi, Vayered Mitzrayma, the same psukim that we read on Pesach, the same psukim that we learn on Pesach, are the psukim that you say when you bring Bikurim. And of course the question is why? Why do we have to go through a whole Jewish history in order to bring Bikurim? And there's many answers, but the answer that I'd like to share with you now as an introduction to what I want to talk about today is because when we say thank you, our thank you has to mean something. If you gave me an envelope and said, here's a present, I could say thank you. But if I opened it and expected, let's say 10 shekel. So I say thank you, it's a nice gift, 10 shekel, very nice, thank you. If I open it and see 1,000 shekel in there, my thank you is going to be a different thank you. Because I know what I received, and therefore I can speak more clearly in my thank you. And that's why we say on Bikurim, Arami Avi Avi, can you have a history lesson? That I didn't just come to Israel and plant this wheat and here it is, but my connection to the land is all the way back to Yitziat Mitzrayim and Knisa La'aretz. That's one of the reasons why we say Mikra Bikurim in that way. Today we're celebrating what? We're celebrating Jerusalem Day, Yom Yerushalayim, and I felt that I wanted to give a little background so that our thank you can be more meaningful. We heard a moment ago Lieutenant Colonel Tzvi Kaspi talking about his experiences and how he was so excited that that in the winter he would get tea with a little sugar. That was during the Tzema, the austerity measures. The austerity measures is what happened in the early 50s. We had no money. The country had no money. And so for a man to still today, 60 whatever years later, still today appreciate a little sugar in his tea. So that's one component that will help us celebrate today. I wanted to be a little bit more specific of the events of June 5th to June 10th, 1967, the Six-Day War. Books and books and books and books have been written about the Six-Day War. And there is no way in the short time we have together I'm going to be able to summarize everything. This was a huge battle, a short battle, war. A huge war, a short war, but a huge war. And I cannot, in a short time, I mean, you could take a course. I couldn't teach it, but you could take a course in the Six-Day War. I'm told, but I wasn't able to verify, that that if you want to become an officer in the United States Army, I'm told, you need to go to, what's it called? West Point, 40 minutes north of Muncie. And I'm told that among other things that you learn there, you learn about great battles in the war, and I understand in history, in the world, and I understand that for a while they taught the Six-Day War, and the way I understand the story going, at some point they took it out of the curriculum because there was not a lot that a soldier, a future officer, could learn because there was no physical, man-made, so to speak, way to have won this war. And so I can't, as an American officer, learn from this war. There's no reason that Israel should have won this war. So there are courses and courses and books and articles. So I'm obviously going to do just the tip of the iceberg to give us a little bit more of an appreciation of what we're celebrating. So you have seen this already, the idea of putting it in perspective, and I talked about it already this evening. Wars do not last 6 days. Wars last years. Wars last, here we have, the American Revolution lasted more than 3,000 days. The first Persian Gulf War was 200 days, a very short war, 200 days. The war in Afghanistan, I don't have a number, because we're still going, 4,200 days. And yet, the Six-Day War lasts 6 days. So let's understand a little bit of a perspective of what we're celebrating. The Middle East, on the eve of the Six-Day War, looks like this. If you're sitting far away from the screen, you're going to need a telescope to see Israel. If you're sitting up close, you're going to need a magnifying glass. Israel is the little yellow over here. This is the result of the armistice in 1949. We had some land, of course. We were celebration, no question about it. Yom HaTzmaut, 1948, no question about it. But you can see that we're surrounded, and this is not news to anybody here, absolutely surrounded by people who for 19 years, 48 to 67, for 19 years were still angry, embarrassed, staking their entire reputation, staking their faith on the fact that what happened in 1948 was a disaster, and we are going to revenge the honor. And we were surrounded by people who wanted us dead. The ratio, if I'm not mistaken, was something like 30. We were surrounded by 30 soldiers to every single Jew in old Israel. In other words, for every single man, woman, and child living in Israel between 1940 and 1967, for every single one of them, there were 30 soldiers surrounding us, ready to pounce for personal reasons, for political reasons. Okay. What started the war? There's an expression, I think it's pronounced causus belli, which is both singular and plural, to mean acts or an act or situations that provoke or justify a war. You know, or you should know, and you will know today, that Israel and people will tell you that Israel started the war. Well, let's see who actually started the war. This is, again, a close-up picture of Israel. Israel's the yellow. Israel did not control the Sinai Peninsula, what the world calls the Gaza Strip, what the world calls the West Bank. Yerushalayim is right here. We're going to talk about Yerushalayim specifically. So, first of all, a little background. Number one, you should know that after the 1956 Suez Campaign, Egypt agreed to place UNEF, to place United Nations soldiers in the Sinai to ensure that all parties, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, that all parties would comply with what they agreed to in 1949. So this is a picture in May of 1967. I mean, since 1948, there have been people going across, Israeli soldiers into Egypt, back and forth. There have been bullets, there have been mortars flying back and forth. No war except for 1956. And there are UN peacekeepers after 1956 here. Soldiers. Objective third-party soldiers. They're not defending Egypt, they're not defending Israel, they're not defending anybody, but defending peace. Everyone with me? May 1967. Let's look at three things that happen in May of 1967. Number one, in May of 1967, Egypt expels the United Nations troops. If you're Israel, what are you to think? The only reason why they're there is to make sure that there's no war. Goodbye. He gave them a very short... The general Nasser, the head of Egypt, gave a very short time. UN, get out. We cannot ensure your safety. There's going to be a war. A second thing that was very important, and that is on the same day, Sinai, that was supposed to be demilitarized, was remilitarized. Bring up troops. You bring up troops into the Sinai Peninsula, ready for war. Now, it happens to be that already there were soldiers, as I told you, and we'll do the numbers in a moment, on the Jordanian border, Syria, they were already keeping troops, their tanks, airplanes on high alert. You can't do it for very long. You cannot keep your troops of any country on high alert for very long. They have families, they have jobs, the economy can go down the drain. You have to, if you're going to put them there, you're putting them there for a reason. You know, the expression that they say in movies, you know, don't load the gun unless you're ready to use it. So don't put guns and don't put soldiers and don't put airplanes, and you cannot put arms and troops on a border at high alert unless you're ready to use them. It's impossible. So number one, there's no UN troops. Number two, there are Egyptian troops in Sinai. And number three, very important, 1 week later, Egypt closes the Straits of Tiran to all ships flying Israeli flags or carrying strategic materials. The Straits of Tiran were Israel's water gateway to the Red Sea, and therefore to the Far East and South Africa. It was Israel's primary source of oil. And all of a sudden, Israel is not allowed to troops there. Oh yeah, can I put this over here? If you don't mind. Okay. Israel's not allowed to, there's no boats that are allowed to travel up through the Straits of Tiran into the port of Eilat to be able to supply Israel with much needed goods and oil. We are shut off from the world, at least from that area. Three things that Israel felt was a casus belli, reasons that war has started, even if bullets have not yet flown. Okay. Preparations for war. Listen carefully, ladies, as you're dancing later. Listen carefully to the state of affairs. And again, those of you in one of my classes yesterday, I apologize for a little bit of the repeat, but I think it's important to hear it anyway. Number one, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Morocco, Algeria, Libya, Kuwait, Tunisia, Sudan, and of course the PLO, amass troops on Israel's borders. There are half a million troops ready, 240,000 troops from all these countries amassing on the Israel's borders, 2,500 tanks, and almost 1,000 combat aircraft. Well, comparing that with Israel also amassed troops. They amass about half the number of troops, about less than a third of the tanks, and less than a third of aircraft. We are outnumbered, outfunded, and this is in May, early June, 1967. Preparations for war continue. 10,000 graves are dug. As Tzvi Kaspi said, 40 were dug in Chalavim, 1,000 here, 500 there. It is a necessity, because as bad as it is for morale to dig graves, it's worse to have dead bodies rotting in the streets. And of course, we're going to need 10,000 graves. 14,000 hospital beds are readied. Preparations are made for evacuating Israeli children to Europe. Imagine you're a young mother living in 1967. You hear about graves in your neighborhood. If I'm not mistaken, there were graves dug. Do you know when you take the 31 bus from Tachanah Merkazit? So you pass, you drive out of Tachanah Merkazit, it makes a right, and it drives, and the hotel, it used to be the Hilton, is on the right, that tall, what's that hotel called? Used to be the Hilton. On the left, they're building apartment buildings. Mm-hmm. That was a cemetery. And they dig graves there. You've been to Gane Yehoshua in Tel Aviv, digging graves there. So you're a young mother, you've got to make plans for your children, maybe yourself, to go to Europe if you need to. There's hospital beds, you understand, that are being built. We continue. Antidotes for poison gas are stockpiled. This is all before June 5th, 1967. 20,000 gas masks arrive, of all places, from Germany. We are getting ready for war. Thousands of volunteers arrive from the diaspora. It's one of the few bright spots of a pre-Six-Day War mentality, when you have people coming off the plane ready to do whatever it takes, volunteer in hospitals, whatever it takes. And Jews forever have been doing that, have been coming here and helping out when necessary, and we're on the brink of real disaster. Keep going. Civilians dig fortifications and defenses. Oh yeah, in between school, if there was school, you've got to dig a trench in your backyard, or you've got to dig a trench. Some of you may know people and teachers here live in Ramat Eshkol. I have an aunt that lives in Ramat Eshkol. Right across the street from Ramat Eshkol is Givat HaTachmoshet. That was an army area, but civilians were used to dig the trenches there. The feeling was, there was a, quote, sense of approaching catastrophe of the Jews' abandonment to yet another Holocaust. There was talk of widespread bombing of Israeli cities, of an entire generation of soldiers being wiped out. A lot of the quotes and information is going to come from one book. There's so many books. Michael Oren, outstanding book, very detailed. It's this thick. I'm talking for a few minutes. It's this thick. It's a life's work. So that's the way, that was the feeling of being in Israel. In reply to a daily newspaper, it's called Davar, the Prime Minister Levi Eshkol predicted in Yiddish, and I cannot read this in Yiddish, but this is the Prime Minister speaking of why he has to find a peaceful solution. Because if we go to war, blood will run like water. This is the Prime Minister talking. The trick wasn't to win the war. The trick was to survive long enough that, you know, a few Jews can survive in major cities. We're of course not winning the war. There's no way we can win the war. But we can at least survive, a lot of us, God willing. More preparations for war. Am Chacham V'Navon. In everything we talk about today, we have to talk about not only the genius of the Israeli military, but where that genius came from. Everything we're saying today, we're not saying Kochi V'Otzem Yadi. What we're saying is that God enabled us to do literally the impossible, as you just saw. Literally the impossible. What'd they do? Next, first. Israeli pilots and ground crews train extensively in rapid refitting of aircraft returning from sorties, enabling a single aircraft to sortie up to 4 times a day as opposed to the norm in the Arab forces, which was 1 to 2. Sortie is a flight, bomb, and come back. Israel learned how to do 4 in a day, double the amount of Arab air forces. 2, IDF soldiers practice endlessly driving vehicles through soft dunes of the Negev. They discovered that vehicles would get greater maneuverability in desert terrain if tires are partially deflated. As a result, they can choose their angle of attack and advance through areas the Egyptians least expected. The Egyptians expected a ground war from Israel, but the terrain is so rough, there's only a few roads. So they heavily fortified the roads, not knowing that Israel was training simultaneously to drive on no roads. And all you have to do with this example, there's so many examples, I chose a few. I'll call them miracles, but that's going to be at the end. Other people will call them teva. If you just deflate your tires. Next. Israeli army orders soldiers be supplied with 1 liter of water every hour. They used to have 1 liter every day. As a result, soldiers were able to do more, survive more, run more, shoot longer than their Egyptian counterparts. Mossad agent Eli Cohen, you probably heard of him, hopefully you have, infiltrated the highest ranks of the Syrian government. And he provides crucial intelligence to Israel. For example, which maybe you heard, I hope you did, that he was pretending to have sympathy for the Syrian soldiers. He ordered eucalyptus trees to be planted by every Syrian embankment to shade them. When it came time to war, Israeli Air Force pilots were told, shoot all the eucalyptus trees. And you shoot the eucalyptus trees, you blow up every Syrian embankment, every Syrian mutav, fort, just from Eli Cohen. Eli Cohen was discovered and hanged. His wife didn't even know he was a spy. One of the incredible heroes of the state of Israel. We can call it nature, we can call it brains, or we can call it God arranging, setting the table for us. Mossad also carries out surveillance on Egypt. By the time the war broke out, the Mossad had either a field intelligence officer or an Egyptian informant in every single Egyptian airbase and military headquarters. 3 staff officers at the General High Command headquarters of Egypt for spies for the Mossad. Getting ready for war, am chacham v'navon. This is the punchline, ladies. The war begins, Hashem yilachem lachem. Unforgettable. On June 5th, 1967, at 7:45 a.m. Israel time, the IAF, Israel Air Force, launches Operation Mokade, Operation Focus. Every single Air Force jet that was operational, except for 12, take off at 7:45, which basically means leaving the entire Israel defenseless. Almost 300 planes take off. Now, they have been taking off for days and days and days. Egypt, Jordan, Syria were used to planes and groups taking off out into the Mediterranean and down the Red Sea and back up. Many Israeli warplanes headed out over the Mediterranean before turning back onto Egypt, all over the place. Many went down the Red Sea, as they always did, and in the last minute, turned in, went as far south as Luxor. Listen to this. Before the war broke out, Egypt's Air Force was on a high alert. One third of their planes were in the air at all times. One third of the pilots were sitting in the ground, in their jets, it should read. Sitting in their jets on the ground at all times. And one third of the pilots were resting. By the time Israeli jets crossed into Egypt at 8:15 a.m., the one third of the pilots who were flying had landed and were briefing the other pilots who were about to take off. They were eating breakfast. There were four Egyptian planes in the air at 8:15 in the morning on June 5th. They had no guns. They were training jets. Keep going.
They said that.
Meanwhile, the Egyptians shut down their entire air defense system. Egyptian soldiers were commanded not to shoot at any plane in the air, as they were worried that their own forces would accidentally shoot down two high officers, Field Marshal Amer and Lieutenant General Mahmoud, who were flying in the Sinai at the time. You want to call this coincidence? You want to call this genius? I think we're going to call this Hashem Yilachem Lachem. You have a huge, three times the amount of jets ready to fight against us. Israel says we'll get them when they're having breakfast, when they're having coffee. And we'll fly at a time, I don't think they knew this, when they were told, when Egyptian officers and soldiers were told, don't shoot any planes, we don't trust you. More. War begins. Jordanian radar operators, operating one of the most sophisticated radar facilities in the Middle East, saw the incoming aircraft. They had seen Israeli planes before go out to the Mediterranean, but not in these numbers. They repeatedly radioed the word inab, which means grape in Arabic. It was the code word for war. And that code word eventually made it to the office of Egypt's chief of staff. And it made it to Egypt's defense minister. Inab! There's a war! The Israelis are coming! The Israelis are coming! The call went unnoticed. The Egyptians had changed their codes the day before and had not yet notified the Jordanians. Indecipherable grape. Sorry, we'll move on to something else. War begins. Israel attacks Egypt's Air Force in a most unique way. They bombed the planes parked on the ground, but priority was given to bombing the runways. Surviving aircraft were useless. To bomb runways, Israel used Durandal bombs. No one knew Israel had them. They were developed secretly together with France, leaving craters more than 16 feet wide and 5 feet deep. You can have the fanciest plane in the world with the best jet, with the best pilot in the world, with no runway, it's a big tin can. Delayed fuses on the bombs made repairing the runways impossible. The strategy was a huge success, destroying virtually all of the Egyptian Air Force on the ground with few Israeli casualties. Over 300 Egyptian aircraft were destroyed and 100 Egyptian pilots were killed in 2 hours. Within 2 hours of the initial attack, Major General Mati Hod, commander of the Israel Air Force, reported to the IDF's chief of staff, Yitzhak Rabin, quote, "The Egyptian Air Force has ceased to exist." 2 hours. Hashem Yilachem Lachem. Pictures of Israeli Air Force, pictures of planes on the ground, which very difficult to repair. The war continues. Anyway, this is just an idea. Israel maintained radio secrecy. Its population and most of the world was unaware for the first days of the war of their tremendous successes. I mentioned this in one of my classes yesterday. It's important for you to know. You are sitting in a bunker with your family. They're hungry. They haven't seen sunlight. You're expecting who knows what to happen. And the only radio stations you can listen to are Egyptian radio stations. And Egyptian radio stations are not about to admit that their entire air force basically has been decimated. They have no runways. There was one runway in all of Egypt, one Air Force base, I'm sorry, in all of Egypt that was left untouched. Not because of Israel's incompetency, but because Israel used that later in the war for their own planes to take off and land and refuel. They had to leave one Air Force base ready. Anyway, Nasser was not about to let his friends, the Jordanians, the Syrians, he was not about to let them and all the others let them hear that he basically failed before the war even started. So Jordan was reluctant to enter the war, and Israel warned it, "Do not get involved." General Nasser of Egypt used the confusion to draw other countries into the war. "We are marching on Tel Aviv." Now you're sitting in your bunker. "We're marching on Tel Aviv. If you don't join the war, we are going to get all the glory, and all of Palestine is ours, Jordan and Syria. You better join in." And he used this silence. So you're shaking in the bunker. I mentioned to some of you that Rabbi Willig Shlita was a Shana Aleph boy in KBY that year. And he himself witnessed, if you want to travel from Egypt to Tel Aviv, you pass right through, if you're an Egyptian soldier, you're going to pass right through KBY. KBY in those days and today, dormitories, chadar ochel, sleeping facilities. And Rabbi Willig himself saw and assisted in placing bombs throughout the Beit Midrash, the rooftops of the dormitory, so that when, not if, but when KBY has to retreat because of the oncoming Egyptian soldiers, they will blow up KBY so that Egyptian soldiers cannot use it as a place to sleep and a place to refresh themselves and keep marching in Tel Aviv. This is the mentality of the first 2 days of the war, at least for anybody who didn't know what was going on. Nasser used that to say, "Jordan, we are marching on Tel Aviv. You want to get a part of this. Syria, we are marching on Tel Aviv. You want to get a part of this." He wanted to draw other countries into the war. False Egyptian reports of a crushing victory against the Israeli army and forecast that Egyptian forces would soon be marching on Tel Aviv influenced Syria and Jordan to enter the war. That was a mistake. By the end of the war, Israel had conquered enough territory to more than triple the size of the area it controlled. It went from 8,000 square miles, 8,000 square miles to 26,000 square miles. The victory, of course, enabled Israel, which we'll talk about right now, to unify Yerushalayim, to capture the Sinai Peninsula, Golan Heights, Gaza Strip, and what the world calls the West Bank. Israel warned them, "Don't get involved." And they listened to somebody else instead. And Israel, by the time the war was over, looked like this instead of like this. When I was a kid still, we had the Sinai Peninsula until 1979. I have a map in my office of a pre-1979 Israel map. This is where Israel got oil, some of their oil. This is where Israel trained. This is where Israel set up kibbutzim and places to live and after 1967. Now, the War of Independence in 1948 resulted in Yerushalayim being divided, as you know. We're going to focus now on Yerushalayim, Yom Yerushalayim, with the old city lying entirely on the Jordanian side of the line. The Kotel and Har HaBayit, of course, were virtually inaccessible. I hope you can see these pictures from where you are. That's what the Kotel looked like. You are marching to the Kotel today. No one's bothering you. I'll quote Rabbi Cohn for the second time today. Rabbi Joel Cohn was the principal of SAR when I was the assistant principal. And he's a few years older than me. And he remembers as an elementary school boy. He was in an elementary school in YCQ. Anybody go to YCQ? In YCQ, he was before 1967, whatever grade he was in. And he remembers the following story. They are called together for an assembly. The whole school, I still remember him telling us this. The whole school gets together for an assembly. When there's an assembly, there's a guest speaker. Who's the guest speaker? Guest speaker gets up and tells a fascinating story, pre-1967. You know what the story is? The story is, I get up and I say, my friend davened at the Kotel. And I want to tell you about it. And he said that all the kids sat there with their jaws dropping. He didn't do it. His friend, in other words, the guest speaker's friend, visited the Kotel and davened there and dodged, bullets from Jordanian snipers. And it was the most incredible story. Davened at the Kotel? It's unheard of. Pre-1967, as you all know. This woman wrote this kind of quickly. During the late afternoon of June 5th, same day, day one, Israel launches an offensive to encircle Jerusalem. The Jordanian defenders, who were heavily dug in, fiercely resisted the attack. All of the Israeli officers, except for two company commanders, lieutenants, were killed. And the fighting was mostly led by individual soldiers. The fighting was conducted at close quarters, in trenches, bunkers, and was often hand-to-hand, Gibat HaTachmoshet, etc., all the areas, Gush area, leading all surrounding Yerushalayim. After fierce fighting for 2 days, Israel gained the upper hand. However, fearing damage to holy sites and the prospect of having to fight in built-up areas, Defense Minister Moshe Dayan orders his troops not to enter the Old City, day two. On June 7th, heavy fighting ensued. Dayan had ordered his troops not to enter the Old City, but he heard that the UN was about to declare a ceasefire 2 days into the war. He changes his mind and, without cabinet clearance, decides to try and capture the Old City. The fighting was conducted solely by paratroopers. Why not tanks? Why not artillery? Why not planes? No, tanks, you're right. One of the tanks got stuck, you're correct. Why not blast through the wall that Suleiman built a few hundred years ago? Israel did not use armor during the battle out of fear of severe damage to the Old City. Paratroopers fought hand to hand because we didn't want to destroy old relics in the Old City. It's fascinating. We grew up with this, but you're kind of used to that. I know of no other army that would ever dream of doing that. But it's Yerushalayim. It's our home, it's our capital. We can't just bomb it. They could have carpet bombed it to no end. We had control of the skies from the first 2 hours of the war. No, we're going to go hand to hand. Reinforcements arrive. Commander of the 55th Paratrooper Brigade, Matagur, radios his men. And this is what he says, quote, El Mifkadei HaGdudim, I'm talking to the officers of the brigades. Anachnu Yoshvim Al Reches, we're sitting on a platform. Shetzofel Ir Atika. Ve'od Me'at Anachnu Omdim. Lihikanes Elea. Can you imagine? This is in the middle of war. There's gunfire in the background. Ha'ir Ha'atika Shel Yerushalayim. Shemeaz Kol HaDorot Chomim Aleha Veshoafim Aleha. We're about to go into the Old City, where for generations, people have dreamed about it and yearned for it. Anachnu nihiyeh, now it's the battle. Anachnu nihiyeh rishonim shenikanes aleha. Israeli officers always go first. He's the highest commanding paratrooper in Yerushalayim, in Israel, and in Yerushalayim, we're going to go first. There's no leading from behind. We're going to go first. Hatankim shel Eitan mitkadmim mismol vikansu l'shar arayot. He didn't know that they were going to get stuck in shar arayot. Gdu 28 and Gdu 21, Lanua El Ashar, follow them. This is 28 and 21, follow the tanks to Shar Arayot. Gdu 66, Lanua Acharehem. excuse me. Lanua, lanua lashar. Move, let's go. We're moving. Misdar siyum, which is an army expression. It means a misdar is when you stand at attention, like an organized.
In order?
In order. Mizdar. What do you say mizdar? We do it in camp. What's it called, the mizdar? The mizdar siyum. The end of the battle. We're all going to line up at attention. Yihyeh el harachava lamala. Going into the old city hasn't even started yet. And he says, we're going to meet in the old city. We're going to meet in the old city. Ad kan avor. Over and out. Over and out. And the old city, within a short time, Matagur, Commander Matagur, gets on the radio and says the following.
Anachnu betof ha'ir ha'atika. Anachnu betof ha'ir ha'atika.
Harabait biadenu. For 2,000 years, every single Jew would have given up their lives. Many did. Harabait biadenu. Exhausted soldiers sitting at the Kotel. We conquer Yerushalayim. Conquer Yerushalayim on day 2, 46 years ago today. Harabait biadenu. This is a thumbnail sketch of the things that they experienced, the emotions that they experienced. Jews lost their lives in this battle and other battles. I went very quickly through the battles in further north, Lebanon, Jordan, Syria. Egypt wasn't over. Just because they have no air force doesn't mean it was over. Many people, as you heard, Tzvi Kotsky's friend was killed on the last day. But we recognize, we have to have an appreciation for the gifts that God gave us. I'd like to end. I wanted to end in a different way, but yesterday was Tuesday. But I heard something yesterday that I shared with a couple of you, and I want this to be the ending of this component. Our family is in the market to buy a new car. So we're looking for a new car, and we have a used car salesman. The used car salesman, and he tells us that we should check out called a Hyundai i20. Nobody cares. Hyundai i20. So he tells us about it. He says, go to the internet, check it out. I've got one for you. This is like 3 days ago, whatever it is. And we finally meet up with him 2 days after he told me to look at the Hyundai i20. And I come to him and I say, it's unbelievable. There's a million Hyundai i20s on the road. So he chuckles, and he says to me, you all are only noticing the I-20 because you're looking for it. He says, I'll tell you a story. Story that I heard yesterday. Only in Israel. He says he was taking a woman in a test drive of a Suzuki Splash. He stops the store and he says to me, have you ever heard of a Suzuki Splash? I say, no. He said, have you ever seen a Suzuki Splash? I say, not that I know. No, I don't think I've ever seen one. Okay. I was taking a test drive with this woman and Suzuki Splash. We stop at a red light. And the woman says to him, I love this car. But there's no Suzuki Splashes. Nobody drives Suzuki Splashes. They're stopped at a red light. He says to her, what's the car right in front of you? She looks, Suzuki Splash. He says, true story, he says, look to the car to your right. Stop the red light. What kind of car is that? She looks, Suzuki Splash. He says, if you're looking for a Suzuki Splash, you'll find a million of them. If you're looking for it, you'll find it everywhere. And I smile, and he says, the used car salesman says to me, just like God. Just like God. If you're looking for God, if you're looking for God, you'll see Him everywhere. And as much as we love Yom Yerushalayim, you don't need to hear about Egyptian pilots drinking coffee at the very moment that they're being bombed by Israel. I forgot a story that one of the Egyptian pilots testifies in Michael Oren's book. He says, I had nothing to shoot. What am I supposed to shoot them with? So I said, okay, all I can do is shoot with my pistol at these jets flying by. Reaches for his pistol. He forgot it in his plane. Didn't even have a pistol to shoot it. You can hear great stories about Inab not making it because one day before, Egyptians changed their codes. If you're looking for God, though, you don't need to, and God's involvement in our world, you don't need to find Him here. This is an experience, no question about it. And you and I both, we're going to dance, till night tonight, because of this. But we really should be dancing tomorrow night also. And last night also. We should have been dancing last night also. Because God runs the world not only when we see miracles in our eyes. If you're looking for a miracle, you'll find it anywhere. God's anywhere. And if there's one message that we walk away about Yom Yerushalayim, it's the message that God runs the world with His own two hands, so to speak. Miracles are waiting for us. It's a little easier, I think, to see it in Israel. It's a little easier sometimes to see it on days like today. But recognize that really God is everywhere. And so when we say Baruch Shehachiyanu v'kiyamanu v'hagiyanu lazman hazeh, and when we say Hodu Lashem Kitov, Ki Le'olam Chasdo, and when we say Zeh Hayom Asa Hashem, Magid Avon Yismach Habo, the truth is we should and could say it every single day. Have a Chag Sameach, everybody.